Good morning on Tuesday, November 3rd, 2015. This is Brian Medden, and you are listening to a BrianMedden.com podcast. I am sitting in my apartment in San Francisco, and apart from Justin, the engineer, it's just me on the podcast today. So Gabe is on vacation with his family and at Disney World. Jack is somewhere, some kind of conference, I think. And Tuesday is our podcast day. So I thought, wow, you know, I've actually never done a podcast by myself. And I thought, yeah, I can probably swing it for an hour. I mean, there's actually a few podcasts I listen to where it's just one person. And anyway, so then it becomes, what's the topic to talk about? Long story short, I realized I've never really told the story of how I got to where I was kind of from scratch. And so that's what I'm going to do in this podcast today. When I connected via Skype, Justin, our engineer, said, do you think you can, you know, fill an hour? And I said, wow, let's see if I can take my story and hold it to just an hour. Though I guess since this is actually just on the internet, it doesn't really matter how long it goes. But this is one of the things that people ask me pretty often as I'm going around and, you know, doing Brian Forum and conferences and that sort of thing. And they always, you know, say, what, you know, how did you get started? How did you get started with Citrix? How did you start with IT? How did you start a company? How do you start a conference? How do you write a book? All that kind of stuff. And so I figured for this podcast, I'm just going to tell that story. And I have no idea if this is a 20-minute story or if this is a three-hour story, but I'm just going to tell that story today. Interestingly, I was very nervous about this, so I don't have any notes or anything really prepared, but I found myself about an hour really being nervous. I don't recall ever being nervous about a presentation in the past, or certainly not a podcast or anything. So, yeah. So let's begin. So the story, here's the story, Brian. So born in 1977, Akron, Ohio. And so, you know, I grew up in the 80s. I'm 37 years old right now, just about to turn 38. I think those numbers are right. We had a typical kind of middle class upbringing, lived in a nice house. We lived in the house that my dad grew up in. My parents were married to each other as long as I was in Ohio. I'm the oldest of four kids. There's a sister, Meredith, who's currently living with her husband in New York City. There's another brother, Dennis, who's living with his wife here in the Bay Area. And then many of you know Jack, the youngest, who also works at TechTarget and blogs about mobility and stuff like that on BrianMedden.com. So, you know, grew up in the 80s, G.I. Joe and Transformers and Legos were big for me. Of course, you know, Star Wars and all that sort of thing. Went to public school, Firestone High School, which incidentally, I was back in Akron a couple of weeks ago, and my elementary school has been torn down and rebuilt with the new elementary school. My middle school has been torn down, and next year they'll be tearing down my high school. So my roots in Akron are no longer really there. But, you know, as a kid, It was my grandfather who he worked at a machine shop, and he was one of these guys. I was very close to him growing up. They lived in the Akron area, and he was just one of these guys who built, fixed, repaired anything. So, you know, he had woodworking tools. He had a machine shop in his basement, you know, metal lathe, milling machine, that sort of stuff. And he was, you know, they lived in a big place out in the country, and he was always, you know, it smelled like oil and grease and was machining things and building things and fixing things and taking things apart. And I think a lot of that, I had that from an early age, just always, you know, the curiosity of wanting to know how things worked and wanting to know, you know, just knowing that it's okay, that it's, you know, it's okay to take things apart if they break. You can't break them more, he used to say. So something breaks, just take it apart. And I was the kid who was taking apart everything, you know, take apart the VCR and put it back together, take apart the toaster, take apart my friend Paul Hudson's Nintendo, because we never had a Nintendo. And of course, every time I took something apart and put it back together, I always had a few extra screws that I thought, well, I could help companies, economize their designs because, hey, these screws are clearly not important. Never mind the fact that Paul Hudson's Nintendo never actually held games down properly after I took it apart and reassembled it, and we had to stick a wood block in there to play Nintendo. But I was the kid, we didn't have a computer. You know, there were Apple IIe's, you know, so I was in grade school in the 80s, and there's a computer lab, and like most of us, I played, Snakebite and Oregon Trail and that kind of stuff. But I wasn't really into computers per se, and the computer classes were not learning about computers. It was just basically an hour of, you know, Apple IIe video game sessions. And so, but I remember I was sort of into electricity and light bulbs and that kind of stuff, and was making circuits with flashlight bulbs and lantern batteries and paper clips and tinfoil and that sort of thing. And then at some point I saw the movie Short Circuit. It was a movie we watched in school for some reason. And then that just got me really fascinated and interested in robots. And so during elementary school, I was sort of obsessed with robots. And, you know, taking out all the books in the library about robots and building them. And now when I say building robots, these weren't real robots. They were truly autonomous and self-thinking. It was basically remote controlled devices. You know, you take apart the inside of a remote control car, you put a trash can upside down on top of it, you put a fishbowl and some tinfoil and some pipe cleaners. And it's a robot that you drive around. But, you know, I used to build robots always for the school science fairs and class projects and all that sort of stuff. And it's interesting too, because at that time also I always, as a kid, you know, so I've always was always taking things apart, but I was always a talker. Also, my mom would always say, "Rest your ear, give my ears a rest." And so, you know, my sort of natural personality that has led me to success later in my career, as far as being on stage and being able to, maintain the attention of an audience and all that kind of stuff, that was something that was there from birth. And even when I was in elementary school, I created, I'm using air quotes, a company as a robot company. It's called BADAM, BAD-AM. And it stood for Brian and Dennis and Meredith. And those are my two siblings. Jack was a sort of a baby at the time. And we built and sold robots, again, air quotes, and built in air quotes, sold in air quotes, and robots in air quotes. What we did do, though, is we had stock. And I was in sixth grade, and I still have the ledger books from this company. I was in sixth grade, and I sold stock in the company. It was a penny a share, and I sold it to people at school, and I sold it to my aunts and uncles and my grandparents and my parents. And at the time, I made like $35. And again, this is, you know, I'm a kid in 1988, like $35, I think my allowance is 50 cents a week. And so, but the whole thing of, I mean, I remember doing marketing for this thing and using little rubber stamps to make flyers and papering the neighborhood with these things, which is horrible in hindsight, but like literally walking up and down the street and just throwing these things in the air and letting them land on the ground, you know, come to our store, the store being the garage where I sold air quotes products, air quotes. But I built the packaging and, you know, I built little battery testers and make boxes, and we had part numbers, and I tracked these in the inventory. I hired coworkers. I built security cards. I built employee identification badges. You know, all of my understanding of big business was based on Nova Robotics, which was the fake robot company in the movie Short Circuit. And even as I was playing Legos, I was building robot headquarters. This is all, you know, BADAM, of course. But even at that young age, you know, fifth, sixth grade, I was kind of the, you know, the Eddie Haskell of the time, and like, you know, like I said, hiring the coworkers and hawking the things and selling the stock and all that sort of stuff. Which ironically is probably not that different than a company who, you know, raises $3 million to hook a dental floss dispenser up to your smartphone, which that is a thing. You know, but this time there's no computers. It's just robots is what I'm most interested in. And there's the books in the library about robots I checked out 100 times over and over and over again. which recently I've actually bought all those books from eBay. And it's really great to sort of pick up the books and open them again 20, 25 years later. These books I had essentially memorized as a kid to sort of see them again for the first time. But there's no computers at this point. And then somewhere my dad ended up bringing home a Texas Instruments, a TI-99-4A. And my dad was – he was a concrete – he poured concrete. So he's a concrete foreman. My mom didn't work. My dad to this day does not have a computer, does not have internet, does not have a smartphone. So I need to ask him. I have no idea where this computer came from. It was something like I found it in our attic and someone put it there and it wasn't me. And we ordered from a catalog, the power adapter and that kind of stuff for it. This is one of the ones that the TI-99-4A, you connected to a TV. And it took cartridges, and it had a basic programming language, TI Basic. And, you know, you turn this thing on and start typing your programs in Basic and you can run them. I still remember the, command call clear was their command to clear the screen. And I used to make little games on this, just little things that flash the screen different colors and timers and little games that played, you know, like, it's going to blow up, run and hide behind the couch and that kind of stuff. And at the time, I didn't have the cassette tape interface. And so any programs that I wrote, I would write down to notebook paper. And, you know, I'd save them by just keeping the computer on all the time. And so if I wanted to, you know, change out programs, I just retyped the entire program into the computer again. So I remember saving money to buy the cassette adapter interface because there was some cassette player, which we also found in the basement. I don't know where all the stuff came from. And so, you know, you can actually load and save your programs from cassette tapes and that kind of stuff. And I learned to program pretty well. I wanted to program my own Mario Brothers game because we were not allowed to have a Nintendo because my mother believed it would rot your brain and all that kind of stuff. And so, but this, the TI, it came with two manuals. It came with sort of a guide to programming, and then it came with a programmer's reference manual. And between those two guides and reading those and learning, and I learned about moving sprites along on the screen and how to, you know, read keys and game run loops and all that kind of stuff. And so I never got too far in these games, but I got to where you could have a little sprite and move around and animate. And, you know, I learned things like when Mario jumps, you can't just change the X or the Y position, you know, like up 10 one by one and then down 10 one by one because it looks like he hits his head on the air. So you have to have sort of like a parabolic formula to, you know, like a smooth jump, which I didn't actually know what that was, but I kind of manually sort of hacked my way through that. So it was really cool. And then around middle school, I got an IBM computer. It was a Leading Edge Model D. This is an XT, you know, 4.77 megahertz. This one had the 640K of RAM, so it had the RAM upgrade, 5 1/4 inch floppies. This one also had a 20 meg hard drive in it, and it ran, you know, DOS, whatever, DOS 3, something like that. And I learned GW Basic, and I was programming a lot of games in GW Basic just for myself, and also designing, you know, I loved the LucasArts games, you know, Police Quest and King's Quest and Space Quest and that sort of thing. Or actually, no, those were the Sierra games. LucasArts was Monkey Island. And so I wanted to write my own game like that. It was a game. It was called Sweet Teens. It was about teenagers being a high school kid and dating. Why you need a game to play what your actual real life is beyond me. But I remember working on these games and just printing out. You know, the way I would work on these games when I wasn't at home was going to school and like printouts of the game code and looking through for bugs. And like, I remember sitting in the bleachers while the other kids were playing like basketball and stuff like that at recess. And I've got like reams of you know, dot matrix printer with the those edges with all the holes in it. You know, as I'm just like going through looking at game code and all this kind of stuff. You know, nothing ever sort of really came to that. But I started learning about computers at least at that time, and I knew that real games were not programmed in Basic, So I found somehow this app called MASM, M-A-S-M, which is Microsoft Assembler, and I got a guide on 8088 assembly language programming from my grandmother for my birthday, which I must have asked her for. And so then I started learning assembly language for the XT, which is actually kind of an interesting jump, like to jump from BASIC into assembly language. That's a harsh thing, but I learned about writing on the graphic stack and, oh gosh, I haven't touched assembly language in 25 years. Peek, poke, pop. I think these are things. But yeah, it was interesting. I never really did anything like that, but I found books in the library that talked about how you can, speed up the performance of your BASIC programs by, writing like certain graphic subroutines in assembler and things like that. So that was sort of my like computer, this is like middle school, kind of early high school time frame. At some point, I bought a 386 from a used one. I paid $250 for it. It had like 4 megs of RAM and 25 megahertz. It was a 386 DX, not to brag there. I remember spending another $250 to buy the Creative Labs kit that had the combo CD-ROM drive and Sound Blaster. And so now I could play, newer like multimedia games. But of course I also remember not having enough memory to really load everything all at once. So I had used DOS config.sys, menus so I could choose, like, do I want the CD-ROM drive or the sound card? I can't actually get both, on this thing. So that went on and I eventually ended up having a job at Baskin-Robbins, scooping ice cream, which, so now I'm in high school, right? I'm 16, 17, 18. This is early 90s. And to this day, I still believe that Baskin-Robbins was the best job I ever had. And people, I've said this seriously, and people have said, oh, you should buy a Baskin-Robbins franchise. And I said, no. Owning a Baskin-Robbins sounds like a terrible job. Working at a Baskin-Robbins sounds fantastic. Because all I'm doing there is scooping ice cream and doing homework and doing computers stuff, and so at the time I was making $4.75 an hour or something like that at Baskin-Robbins, and I was continued to knowing a lot about computers and everything, and I made these brochures that I put on the counter at Baskin-Robbins and say, I would come to your house and fix your computer. And I charged $15 an hour, which was more money than God as far as I was concerned at that age. And it was all cash. And I made these brochures, and it's a little trifold brochures. And I had them, I used a CorelDRAW, which I stole on my 386DX, and printed these brochures. And it was, you have computer problems, come to your house. I've found actually a couple of these brochures more recently. I'll take a photo of one and put it on line with these this podcast. These brochures were very persuasive, and I found that I found them in sort of a memory box a couple of years ago, and I made them when I was 16 or 17, and I was impressed looking back on how persuasive I was in those days, because it said something like, oh, is computer problems too slow, tech support? You could stay on the phone all day with tech support, and but you don't know how to get down on your knees and go behind the computer and do what plug is what. And I said, you could take it to a major retailer like CompUSA, but then you have to disconnect it, and they're going to keep it for several days. Very inconvenient, all in capitals, very inconvenient. And plus, they're a mega retailer. They're going to sell you, they're going to want you to buy what they want to sell you, not what you actually need. What you need is a local college student. I was actually in high school, but I figured college students sounded more legitimate. You need a local college student who actually knows about computers to come to your house, fix it, et cetera. I started that, I think it was my junior year in high school. I did have a driver's license, and I had to pay for my own insurance, but I had access to the old family. The Chariot, as we called it, the 89 Dodge Ram van, maroon in color. And I drove around to people's houses, and you know, so I get phone calls. I got a second phone line installed into my bedroom. I got an answering machine that I you know, some old guy gave me, and it's a kind of answering machine that had the tapes in it, and it had a box, like it looks like the size of a garage door opener, and it's got a button on it, and it emits a tone, and so you can actually call your answering machine from a payphone, which I would do in high school. I'd use a high school payphone, call my answering machine, and then when it's time to record the message, you put this box over the mouthpiece and push the button, and that sends a tone through the wire, and it causes it to play back your messages. And I write down the messages for people who called, you know, because I had my answer machine like, hello, this is Brian Madden from Custom Computer Services. You know, how can I help you today? And I would go there after school, and I had the book of the maps, no, obviously, smartphones or anything, no pagers even. And I would, you know, call them back, find their address, look up their map and the index of this map book, and then drive to their house and, you know, fix their computers. And it was a lot of installing Windows 95, installing memory, you know, upgrading software, installing floppy drives, and, you know, just little kind of Mickey Mouse home computer type repair stuff. But of course, you know, you learn a lot because there's no internet in those days. And so you figure it out on your own, or else you don't go home. And also, I learned you don't get paid if you work on someone's computer for 2 hours and can't fix it. They're not paying you. So I was very incented to actually figure out what I was doing. And it's funny too, because I didn't have a bank account even. So if they wrote me a check, in those days you could actually cash a check at the bank who issued the check without needing a bank account anywhere. So I would like get the check, look at the address on the check, look up. The bank in my map book, drive to the bank, cash the check, and then I was living large because, again, this is all sort of tax-free. And so that kind of grew and grew and grew. And then between my junior and senior year in high school, that summer, I was doing the computer stuff almost full-time. And it was all based on my own business on calls to the home answer machine. And I sort of started supporting small businesses just kind of accidentally. Like, I remember my high school girlfriend's mom worked at this office, and they had a Lantastic network with 10Base2, you know, coax networking, and they needed to add a new computer to it. So I went to CompUSA and bought the kit. I went to Home Depot and bought a giant drill bit that can drill through cinder blocks so I could drill through the hallway and run the cable through the crawl space. And I don't know if I knew what Plenum was in those days, or building codes or any of that kind of stuff, but, you know, I'm 17 and they were paying $15 an hour. And I also did a lot of stuff where, you know, people would call me into small businesses. Like, I did a lot of work for a law firm where it was, you know, the person's wife had known me because I had, you know, fixed their computer at home. And then her husband was complaining about the computers at work, and she's like, call this kid. He came in. And I remember him calling and said, oh, we have a Novell NetWare, I think it was 312 network, and it keeps on sort of going down randomly. And we need someone to come in here as fast as possible to fix it. And so I sort of said, yeah, I can be there in 2 hours. Now, of course, I'm 17. What am I doing? I'm doing nothing. But I'm driving to CompUSA, and they had a big computer book section. I'm finding the books about NetWare to find out what is NetWare. Never heard of it. And you know, instead of buying the book, I just read it there in the store, like kind of flipped through, skimmed, understood how to turn it on, how to log in, how to do whatever. Looked at networking problems, and I saw that the networking problems were typically related, again, to 10Base2 networks, to, you know, issues with the cables being disconnected or faulty connections or that kind of stuff. So over time, I sort of grew and grew and doing more and more sort of small business support and building little access applications for people and just, you know, kind of whatever people needed. So it was sort of trial by fire for desktop support. So this is before my senior year of high school. And then when I was in high school, I'd always kind of naturally been good at math and physics and science and that kind of stuff. So I skipped a bunch of math classes earlier in high school. So my junior year, I took AP calculus. And so there's no math classes left for me at high school my senior year. And they had a program in Ohio with the University of Akron where you could take college classes as a high school kid. And so so I did that. So I actually only went to high school in the mornings. And then at lunch, I left. I went down to Akron U and I took a computer science class and physics and calculus at Akron U. And now this is my senior year. So I'm just coming off of summer, having making $15 an hour, probably billing 20 hours a week, And then school starts again, and I'm back down to, you know, having to fit my, you know, work time around my school schedule. And I realized real quick that they don't take attendance in college classes. And so I had a couple friends who were doing this with me also. Paul Hudson, the guy with the broken Nintendo, was one of them. And we, you know, he and Greg Cox would go on to Akron U, and I would pick up the payphone and call in and beep in to get my messages. And if I had a computer job, I would go do that computer job instead of going to Akron U. And then I realized, so clearly, you know, Akron U did not go well for me. I essentially flunked out of that program, although I was, you know, came up with all sorts of excuses and lies and things like that to sort of hide that from my parents and hide that from the school, because technically I wasn't supposed to be allowed to do that if I failed, but I somehow talked my way into, you know, keeping that alive for the entire year. So essentially I had half days in high school. And I also realized that my only two important classes in high school were only the first two periods, even though I was supposed to be there for all five periods, and I managed to get myself out of the other classes. So essentially my day was freed up by 10 o'clock or so every morning. And then again, all through high school, you know, instead of going to high school and instead of going to Akron U, I'm getting my phone messages and I'm going around fixing people's computers. And I don't know if my parents actually know this, even to this day, that happened. So if they listen to this, that's why I got bad grades as a senior in high school. And that's why I was able to pay for my own limo for prom. But it just kind of grew and grew. And so then, you know, so I graduate from high school. The plan is I'm going to go to Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. But, you know, once summer opened up, again, I could work even more and more and just working full time. And $15 an hour, you know, $2,000 hours a year is $30,000 per year. And so, you know, this is 1996. And, you know, they thought, well, if you get a degree in computer science, you could expect to make $30,000 to $35,000 per year and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, I'm making $30,000 a year now, and I'm enjoying myself, and I have a computer job. Like, why would I go to college? Via a friend of a friend, the NASA facility in Cleveland, it was NASA Lewis Research Center, as it was called at the time, they were doing a Windows 95 migration, and it was 4,000 users going from DOS and Win31 to Windows 95, and it was a huge team doing this. The way it was done, it was all sort of manual. They had zip drives. Remember those things, 100 megs plugged into the parallel ports? And so you go to the desk ahead of time, back up the user's data, do a network install, Windows 95, and then you know, put the data back, and hopefully everything kind of works. So there was like 20 or 25 installers who were going and doing all this sort of installation work. And there's another team of about 10 people, which I was on, which was like the level two people. So we went, before the migration happened, to all the really weird things that people thought would not work well in Windows 95. And so this was, you know, NASA had a lot of hardware connected, like machines connected to microgravity research tunnels and wind tunnels and icing research and wave pools and little robot things and just all sorts of goofball hardware. And so my job was sort of making all this goofball hardware work on Windows 95. And then this is after my senior year of high school, the summer before I'm supposed to go to college. And so first of all, that job paid $20 an hour. So now this is 40 grand a year. And I was just there, you know, as a contractor through another headhunter firm. And I remember telling my dad that, I got a job at NASA. I was literally working at Baskin-Robbins, you know, Sunday night, and then Monday morning driving to NASA for my $40,000 a year job as an 18-year-old, you know, a month out of high school. And my dad flat out thought I was lying. I remember this conversation standing in my kitchen. He says, "Son, you must think I was born yesterday. There is no way they're paying an 18-year-old kid $20 an hour at NASA." And that was more than he made at the time. And I remember showing him my first paycheck. And it was surreal, and I loved it. And I got the reputation there at NASA as being like the whiz kid who could make anything work and figure anything out. And I remember being surprised by that, because, like, I didn't write Windows, I didn't write this, I didn't do anything. I just read the book and made it work. And the time, I think someone had a copy of the Windows 95 Resource Kit, which is about, you know, 1,000-page book that explains all of the DOS compatibility modes and functions and flags and settings and all that kind of stuff. And I got that book and I read the whole thing cover to cover. So I had the reputation of being better than anyone there at fixing anything at NASA. But again, I was like, guys, I just read the book. Like, you can do this too. And so I worked at NASA for a couple of months because then it was time for me to go to college. And of course, before I left for college, the people, my boss at NASA were like, hey, to be clear, there's a job for you here. If you want to hire on as a regular employee, full-time salary, we can do that. And I really sort of wanted to, but my parents were not into the idea of me not going to college. So that really was a non-option. So I left NASA in September, went down to college at Wright State University, lived in the dorms, and I went to classes for, I don't know how long. In my mind, it was a day or two. It may have been a month or two. But it wasn't long before I sort of started doing the same scam kind of down there. And, you know, put out ads that could do computer work and computer repairs and working, that kind of stuff. And then I had also kept in touch with the sort of consulting firm that got me into NASA. And when I was home for Christmas break, which Wright State was on quarter, so they had a month off during Christmas, I worked with them. And now they were paying me $30 an hour. So we're kind of going like, you know, this is late 96 now at this point. So now I'm making 60 grand a year, still as an 18-year-old. And, you know, I do this for a month during December. And clearly there is no way I'm going back to Wright State. Now, I'm too afraid to tell my parents this at this point. So as far as they're concerned, on January, I did go back to Wright State. And I did drive down to Wright State. I remember it was a snowstorm. It was during the Super Bowl. I want to say it was like Green Bay and Boston or something. I think the Super Bowl is snowy. I don't even know if this is a real thing. It might not have even been the Super Bowl. But it was sort of January time frame. And I drive down there, but I'm still talking to people back at this consulting firm, you know, where I worked for that month for Christmas. And I basically, drove down and I sort of lived in Dayton for, it was about a 4-hour drive. I sort of lived there for a few days a week and then stayed with friends and stayed at home and then did a lot of work back in Akron for this consulting company. And after a few months of this, I ended up getting an apartment in Akron and then just not going to Dayton anymore at all. But again, not telling my parents. And I remember being afraid that I was going to run into someone who I knew, like one of my aunts or uncles, who was like, that I would run into them in the grocery store. Because I was sort of secretly living at home in Akron, secretly working, and instead of going to college. And I had all these excuses, like all, you know, worked out ahead of time and what I was going to say and all this kind of stuff. But that went on for a little while. And then eventually, so now we're into 97, I told my parents that I didn't tell them I was going to drop out of college because they would be mad about that. But what I told them, and this is actually true, is that this company called C Group, they're a little Microsoft consulting partner and one of the companies who's up there at NASA that, you know, 20 employees or so. I told them that they had an opportunity for a Windows 95 migration project, and they wanted to hire me to be the sort of the lead engineer of that project since I had, you know, been involved with it at NASA. And Windows 95 is still new at this point, and Windows NT 4 had just come out, but NT hadn't really caught on yet in businesses. And so, you know, a lot of businesses were still running Windows 95. And so I told him, hey, if I leave college for like 6 months, I can work in this project, make enough money to pay for all my college, because, you know, we were doing loans and all that kind of stuff. I didn't have many scholarships because my grades were poor because I was working on computers the whole time. And so I kind of pitched it to my parents that way. And they sort of reluctantly thought, yeah, well, it's a good idea. And, you know, oldest of four kids with more college payments on the way for all them and everything. So we kind of agreed that was a good plan. Incidentally, I think I'm still on break from college. If you see my parents, I'm still in my, hey, let me just take a little bit of time off and then I'll go back later. My grandmother was not happy, I remember, of me sort of leaving college. But what was great is she had a friend named Mabel Graham who was in her 90s and was like an Olympic figure skater from the 1920s. And my grandmother, you know, grew up in the era where you respected your elders. And I remember being at dinner at my grandmother's house and talking to her about, you know, the decision to take a few months off of college and the computer stuff. And she was very upset about this. And Mabel Graham said, good for you, follow your dream, that kind of thing. And my grandmother, respecting the elders, said, okay, if Mabel thinks it's okay, that's, I support it. And she never said a word about it after that, in terms of, you know, not liking that decision. So I'm officially dropped out of college now. I've got an apartment in Akron. I'm working at the C Group company. That company, I was only there for a little while, maybe less than a year. Then I went on to work at Telzon in Akron, Ohio, doing desktop support. And that got me into that's where I first used Citrix. This is 97 now. So if I first used Citrix and I first used SMS. And so I was sort of doing I was an SMS admin. I remember it was SMS 1.2. I was the guy who accidentally installed it onto all the backup domain controllers in the Telzon domain without really exactly knowing what I was doing. We had Citrix for the help desk app. It was WinFrame, and it was running on Cubix hardware, which they were sort of like the original x86 blade manufacturers. So I was at Telzon for a little while. That was fine. And then every job I went to, I was making a few more dollars an hour, a few more, and just kind of growing. And Telzon was fine, but it wasn't. It was in-house, and I sort of missed being out in the world and seeing lots of different companies instead of being sort of like locked into one company. So through a friend of a friend, I ended up getting a meeting with the headhunter or a recruiter from VanStar. I got hired on to work at VanStar. So I joined VanStar in 1998. VanStar was a really large integrator, 2,000 or 3,000 employees, I think publicly traded. And I worked in the VanStar Cleveland office. And I was a systems engineer, and so I was doing MCSE type work. I never had my MCSE, but I was doing that type of work, and just random Exchange, SQL, Windows servers, Win servers, DNS, all that kind of stuff. I remember my very first day at VanStar, like literally my first day. They said, hey, we're doing this Lotus Notes migration. They're migrating from Notes to Exchange for a law firm, and they have like 30 email servers, and we upgrade one or two servers at a time at night. And so it goes from, you work from like 9 p.m. till it's done every single night. And the project isn't going well, and since you know Lotus Notes, why don't you go go up there and see if you can help them out. So this is like my first day. I walk into the office. They tell me this at 10 o'clock. They say, go home, go back to bed, lay down, rest, and then report here to this company in downtown Cleveland at 9 o'clock tonight. And of course, they thought I knew Notes because apparently it was on my resume. I may have used Notes once. I'm not really sure. So instead, I go to CompUSA, I buy the book about Lotus Notes. I spend all day reading that book because I'm only 18 or 19 years old. So, you don't need sleep at that age. And I come in for this project, and basically it's just following scripts. Someone else had already designed all the migration. It's just following scripts and just following all the instructions and then having a little bit of intelligence if something goes wrong. But I was able to do that. So I spent 2 or 3 weeks there working nights, and that cemented my reputation within VanStar, within the Cleveland office anyway, as being like this wonder kid who could fix anything and like save this project. And again, I'm thinking to myself at this time, I just read the manual. I literally just follow scripts and read the manual. I don't know what it is. But I was enthusiastic. I was 19 years old, and I guess that was enough. So around this time, I had known Citrix from working at Telzon. So this is kind of early 98, mid 98. Since I had always been entrepreneurial, for those of you who work in consulting companies, there's the big focus is on utilization. How many billable hours do you spend per month versus how much time you spend sitting on the bench? And if you're sitting on the bench and not billing, that does not look good, both in terms of raises and in terms of just who they're going to fire and all that kind of stuff. So I knew I kind of had to stay busy. So on the downtimes, this is around the time when Microsoft was talking about their Hydra project, which ultimately became the Terminal Server Edition, and the whole thing with, was Microsoft going to kill Citrix? And then Citrix announced they're going to do MetaFrame. Microsoft is going to do Terminal Server. They're going to work together. This whole thing was called thin client computing and seemed kind of like a big deal. So I decided that I was going to put on a seminar about thin client computing. And so for the Cleveland office of a Vanstar in 1998. I remember calling the local Citrix rep, the partner manager, who's a guy, actually a guy named Eric Puccio, who's still in the industry. He's lives in Denver now, and I think he worked at Citrix for a long, long time. You might still be there, but anyway, Eric Puccio was my guy at Citrix, and I got us, you know, a silver partnership and got Citrix certified and you put together a seminar. And when I did the seminar, I mean, it was going to the sales reps and getting their lists of customer addresses. And I designed the brochure because I knew how to do that from CorelDRAW, literally in CorelDRAW again, because I had done that in high school. I remember, you know, buying a bunch of stamps, buying a bunch of stickers, buying, you know, to print out the addresses, and like sitting at home in my apartment and, you know, printing out all these brochures or printing out all these flyers, folding, taping, stamping, stickering, and getting people to come to the seminar. And that seminar, I remember it was August 6, 1998. It was my first speech I ever gave. And I was super nervous. I did not sleep 1 minute the night before. I think there's a VHS tape of this somewhere. So I need to see if I can dig that up because I'd be so curious. You know, I had my like little white shirt on and tie and probably like khaki pants. And I gave a presentation about thin client computing. I still have the slides. I think the slides are on robmadden.com that I used, and the benefits of server-based computing and you know, all that kind of stuff. So based on that, it was all for our customers. And based on that, we got a few projects. I remember the very first Citrix project I actually did was for American Greetings. And they wanted to use Citrix for something. And since I didn't really know it, apart from playing with it in labs, we charged them like half the rate, sort of the hourly rate we charged in half, saying, hey, I'm going to kind of learn this on the job along with you, but I think we can make it happen. I've been playing with it. It seems good. And they went for it. And so, you know, that kind of grew and grew. And then I became sort of typecast as the Citrix guy in the Vanstar office. And then, of course, you know, Vanstar had like 100 offices all around the country. And they were like, I was only in the Cleveland office, working with all the Cleveland-based, you know, like with that sort of, you know, branch office. But my boss, you know, he would go on the regional calls that has like as far away as Toledo and Columbus and Lansing, Michigan, and all these places, and you know, just on their monthly calls to talk about what they're doing in their business. And he kind of says, hey, we got this kid who's, you know, got us a Citrix partnership, and we're doing Citrix stuff, we're getting a lot of business on that. You guys should do it too. And so that's when I sort of started traveling, because I would travel to the other offices in our region, again, Toledo, Columbus, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, you know, Louisville, like these kind of far off exotic places to a kid who grew up in Akron and I think had only been on an airplane once at that point. And I was driving to these other cities, and I would go there and spend like a week in each city and work with their engineers on how Citrix works. I set up servers. I help them do it. I make brochures for their events. I send out all the brochures for the events. I made the presentation in the city. And so in the course of, you know, the next, I don't know, 3 or 6 months in sort of late 98, I had done Citrix presentations and sort of launched, if you will, the Citrix practice at, you know, 4 or 5 kind of regional offices. This, incidentally, it's a sidebar, is where I met Gabe. So Gabe is a year younger than me, and he grew up in the Cleveland area. We did not know each other as kids, but Gabe had his uncle ran the service department at the Cleveland Vanstar office, and his, you know, the service department, because Vanstar also had the service contracts like for HP and that kind of stuff. If he had like warranty service to replace a, you know, hard drive, and they were going to people's houses and all this kind of stuff. So Gabe was kind of like a break-fix guy. And he had sort of shown promise, I guess, and they were going to bring him over to the group that I was in, the consulting group. And we were introduced by one of the sales reps who knew both of us. And she was like, oh, there's this other guy. He's coming over. He's really smart. He's a young guy too. Because remember, I'm 19 years old. He's 18. Everyone else we're working with is like married and kids and like real adults and that kind of stuff. And so so the sales rep, Kathy Ehas, she introduced Gabe and I, and you know, we met at a happy hour. We were both underage, by the way, at this point, but because we wore ties and because we were with other actual grown-ups, we were able to get into bars no problem. And we just realized that we have to just conveniently be in the bathroom when they're ordering the first round, when the actual adults are ordering the first round, and then we're back at the table again, in business looking with all ties and everything. Plus, this is the suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio in 1998. Who cared? So, you know, that's how we drank in those days. And I remember standing outside the night I met Gabe. It was November 98. And just pitching him hard on Citrix and server-based computing and thin clients and, you know, this is great technology and it's a future and all this kind of stuff. Because he just joined our group. He's like fresh meat, you know. He just joined our group. And I'm pitching him hard on, you got to focus on this and you should work on it and make this your, you know, your area. And we're getting all this business and all this sort of stuff. And that was the beginning of a fast friendship between Gabe and I. And so we were still doing a lot of the stuff, a lot of projects together. I remember getting a call to do something for Citrix Extranet in Toledo. And Citrix Extranet was this product. It was like a external VPN, a site-to-site VPN product that Citrix had licensed from a company called V1, I think. So it wasn't really related to Citrix thin client computing at all, but it was from Citrix, so they assumed that we knew it. And this guy's extranet wasn't working, and they had Gabe and I, you know, go out and do it. And I remember driving. I think it was my car, and Gabe was driving, and I'm reading the manual for extranet out loud on the two-hour drive from Cleveland to Toledo so that we can, like, learn extranet. And then there's two of us. So, like, we could tag team. Like, one of us could, you know, go – could be working with the customer, and the other one could pretend to get – page. We didn't have cell phones in those days. We had like beepers. So one of us could get beeped and like walk out to take the call, air quotes, and we're really opening the manual and looking to the exact section that we're supposed to be helping with. But I guess it worked. And, you know, that was, you know, so Gabe became a Citrix guy too. And there's another guy, Dennis Imhoff, in that office who we sort of recruited to be a Citrix guy. And we got folks from some of the other cities as well, and we sort of put together we call it the Thin Client Jamboree, and it was an internal event at for Vanstar employees. So we had in Columbus, and all the Vanstar employees who I had met in these other cities when I was doing the seminars, you know, they got them into Citrix. It was like an internal Citrix conference. I remember we had what was his name, the Citrix SE of the time. It'll come to me. He drove a blue Audi TT Roadster with a child seat in back, which I thought was cool. So anyway, we did this and just got more and more projects, and we're talking and helping each other. And actually, you know, over time, over a year or so, I legitimately learned what I was talking about when it came to Citrix. And of course, my sphere of influence was just the greater Ohio area because that was our region. But of course, when my boss's boss, the regional director, got on the phone with his peers, he said, hey, we're doing these events, you know, for this Citrix thing. We got this guy, started this team, and we're getting a lot of business from it. And then so next thing you know, I'm now going to areas outside the region. I'm going as far away as Kansas City and, you know, other places and just kind of doing the same thing. So over the course of a year or 18 months or so, I went to lots of companies. I mean, lots of our locations of our office over like 20 or 30 cities and given speeches. And I remember, like, I think when we got into 99 was iForum. I don't remember the details in there, but that was sort of came in. The thin list was big in those days. So I was, in addition to learning a lot about Citrix within the company, I was also starting to get, you know, learn other people's names. Like Rick Mack was involved in that. And, I believe Jeroen Vandekamp was there. Ron Oglesby, Greg. Why am I forgetting your last name, Greg? Greg Reese. Anyway, so you know, we just kind of got the whole community built up around the Citrix thing, and just doing sort of more and more work. I ended up leaving Vanstar. Vanstar was bought by Inicom. Inicom sort of went bankrupt, and then I found myself working at this other company called Frontway, which was another sort of small startup company, but I knew a lot of people from there. Gabe came over to Frontway also, and this was kind of where we were around 2000 or so. And so again, at Frontway, we were both hired to build the Citrix practice. We called our group Cataboo, which stood for Cleveland Application Delivery Internal Business Unit. And we focused on SMS and Citrix. Even in those days, we really viewed SMS and Citrix as being similar because they're all about you know, delivering Windows applications to end-user devices. So it's very much focused on sort of desktop management, desktop application installation, and Citrix application delivery. So Gabe and I are both at Frontway. So we're at Frontway for like a year and a half. At Frontway, that's where I met this guy named Scott Archer. And Scott Archer, he's still out there also. I actually ran into him at VMworld maybe 2 years ago. Scott Archer is the reason I wrote a book. He's the reason, probably the why, I'm standing here today doing this podcast, because Scott Archer wrote a book about Windows 2000 Active Directory. And I actually, I found a copy of his book. I recently bought it. I found a copy of his book at the Weird Stuff Warehouse in Sunnyvale about a year ago. And it was one of those New Writers books. It was hardcover, like the blue and white ones. It was like, I don't know, 2,000 pages long or something like that. And I'm like, and he was just a random, he was in the Indianapolis office of Frontway. And he was sort of just a random coworker of mine, but he wrote a book. And I'm like, what? Like, how do you write a book? That just blew my mind. He's like, no, you know, you get a publisher and you, you talk to them, they pay like a dollar a book and they give you an advance and you know the topic and everything. And that to me was just so cool. I wanted to write a book. At this point, I didn't even know what I wanted to write about. I just knew that I wanted to write a book. Like if Scott can do it, I can do it. So the first thing I was researching topics and I had three ideas I could write about. One was Citrix. One was SMS, and one was Fastlane technology, Active Directory migrations, because we were also doing a lot of like Windows NT to Active Directory domain migrations. And there's a company called Fastlane, which I think maybe they were bought by Quest. I don't know that for sure. Maybe now part of Dell, or I don't know. But Fastlane was a company in the early 2000s that did. They had tools for doing like domain to AD migrations and that kind of stuff. So that was a topic for the book also. So I did some research. I want to say it was on Amazon. I think Amazon was a thing at this time. And just sort of researching what other books were out there. And there's a whole lot of books on SMS. The Active Directory thing I thought was maybe kind of too obscure because I was going to write a book about the Fastlane tools, not about general Active Directory migrations. And there's a bunch of books on general Active Directory migrations anyway. And then Citrix, there was one book about Windows NT, Terminal Server Edition. There was one book that was like a Citrix CCEA study guide, but there wasn't really any books on like how to do Citrix, you know, because I always figured like anyone can read the manual. But when you read the manual, that kind of says, well, here's option A and here's how it works and here's option B and here's how it works and here's option C and here's how it works. At this point, I've been doing Citrix for, I don't know, 3-4 years and like doing a lot of it. And I saw a lot of different projects, and because of my role within both Advanced Star Intercom and then into Frontway, I had visibility to a lot more projects than I was actually working on. So other engineers would escalate to me and I would do design reviews and that kind of stuff. So I had like a lot of legitimate experience with Citrix. This is Metaframe 1.8 days. And then Citrix at this point has announced Metaframe 2.0 is coming. It's going to have a lot of big changes. The product that ultimately became Metaframe XP. So I figured, okay, I want to write a book, but I, you know, rather than rehashing the instruction manual, I want to just sort of take my experience and say, look, read the instruction manual first, and then read this book. And when you read this book, you know, I'm going to say, okay, here, like, break it out by design, like, because I've been a consultant my whole career, so I had a very consultative approach to like doing projects and designing Citrix and that kind of stuff. So I really walked through, here's the decision points you need to make, here's all the factors that weigh into it, think about this, here's pros and cons and different options and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I decided I was going to do this book about Citrix Metaframe XP. I don't remember how I decided I was going to self-publish this book. I think I remember hearing that, you know, Scott Archer was making like a dollar per book, but books were selling for like $40 or $50. And I was like, well, like when I go into Borders and pay $50 for an IT book, if the author gets the dollar, where did the other $49 go? Like, I want some of those. And so I kind of looked into how the book industry worked. And I don't remember if this is web searching. I remember buying a book from Dan Pointer, like the self-publishing manual or something like that. And he explained how the industry works. You know, the retailer takes a 50% cut. The wholesaler takes 10%. The distributor takes 20%. But there is like 20% left for the book for like the publisher. And 20% of a $40 book is $8. And $8 is obviously a lot more money than $1. So I'm sort of looking at this. I had a lot of experience. I had a reputation for myself on the thin list. And I was thinking like, well, if I self-publish this, there's got to be something there. And there was no print on demand in these days. It was when you self-published, you literally went to, and the self-publishing book explained how to do this. You went to the book manufacturing factories and got RFQs from them. You told them, I want a book. It's going to be 700 pages. It's going to be this size paper. It's going to be this. And then you're going to send them, a PDF. And then they, make your books and send it back to you. And then it's on to you to sort of distribute. And Amazon at the time had the Amazon Advantage program. So I was able to, ship books to Amazon and everything. So anyway, I ended up, doing this book. At the time, so this is now we're in 2000. At the time, I thought this book was going to take me 6 weeks to write, because what do I know? it actually ended up taking 9 months. I wrote the book. I talked about it on the thin list. I sent out sample chapters to people. I sent out for reviewers, for them to review. The two guys, Sean Casey and Shane Broomhall, actually like read every word of every page and gave like lots of feedback and everything. I did all the page layout myself, so I got I think it was PageMaker in those days, and I designed the cover. Paul Hudson's back in the picture at this point. He's the guy whose Nintendo I broke and who's going to Akron U with me. He did like some graphic stuff, and he helped me like kind of lay out the cover and that sort of thing. So I got this book done and ready to go. And I remember, the publishing company, the printing company, they want money. They don't want credit cards or IOUs or whatever. Like if you're ordering 13,000, or no, that wasn't my, it was 3,000 books. If you're ordering books from them, like, you send a check with your order, and then a semi truck delivers the books to you when it's done. Wow, I talked for an hour already. It doesn't matter. I'm gonna keep on going, even if it takes another hour. So 2000. I just finished my book. I have a lot of debt at this point also because of living just way, way above my means. And I think a lot of that comes from, kind of growing up, like not a lot of money. Like we weren't poor necessarily growing up, but just not a lot of money, not a lot of like fancy things. And then my decision to drop out of college, I was still kind of living in the shadow of that and like kind of ashamed almost. No, I'm not ashamed, but like I had to prove myself that it was the right decision. So I was like, bought a car that I couldn't afford, TV, stereo, all the other garbage that like you shouldn't, an 18-year-old should not go from working at Baskin Robbins to making 60, 70, 80 grand a year overnight. Like 18-year-olds are dumb. And I was a really dumb 18-year-old. And so I just got, in my mind, I always justified having debt because I could always every year I make more and more money. I can pay this off. I'm just kind of getting ahead in life and all that kind of stuff. I had like $30,000 in debt, not like the craziest, hugest thing, but it's all revolving credit card debt. That's another reason why I wanted to, I was getting married at the time. And when my wife-to-be found out that I had all this debt, it was like a major relationship shocker because I hid that from her for a long time also. I'm not married now, and I was married for just a few years, and that the debt is not why I'm not married. But I had no money. I had $30,000 in debt. I had no money, but I had to like get these books printed. So I had a credit card, or maybe I used a credit card that I had with my dad as a co-signer, which I don't know if he knew he was a co-signer on this at the time. I don't recall the details, but I had a credit card that had a $13,000 limit on it. I worked out. $13,000 can buy you 3,000 books from the printer. I did the cash advance, like literally where you write yourself a check, against your credit limit and get cash. And so I bought $13,000 worth of books. And I remember doing the math and figuring out that I only needed to sell like 700 copies to break even. And so I thought, yeah, I can sell 700 copies of this book, like this, you know, no problem. So I get these books printed. I'm living in Washington, D.C. at the time. I'm working at a Compaq. And because this Frontway company where Gabe and I were working kind of went bankrupt also. So I also found myself needing a job. And one of the guys I'd known at Frontway got a job at Compaq. And so he hooked me up with the people in D.C. at Compaq. So I was doing the same stuff. I was doing Citrix consulting. I was in Compaq Global Services, their consulting group. And I was just doing my day job was kind of Citrix consulting and that kind of stuff. So I order these books, and you know, get them printed. They were printed by United Graphics in Mattoon, Illinois, and they printed all of our books, actually, even the more recent ones we've done. And actually, just recently, about a year ago, when I was in Illinois for Bri Forum, I visited them and actually saw. I met the people I've been working with because it's like this is a Midwestern printing company. It's literally the same CSR and the same sales rep that I've had for, you know, whatever it was, 15 years at that point. And I saw the machines that printed the books and met all them and shipping and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, so I send them money. I order 3,000 books because that's how much books you could buy with $13,000. And they're delivered via semi-truck. And they're delivered 3,000 books. That is four pallets. Like each pallet stacked full of cardboard boxes full of books. The stacks are like as tall as me. There's four of them. And I think there was like 260 boxes that were 30 books or 30 pounds a piece or something like that. I was living in an apartment in DC, so I didn't have like any kind of warehousing capabilities for these books. But my uncle, who lived in the DC area in Silver Spring, he had a house and he had a crawl space and he agreed to let me, store my books in his crawl space. So I took the day off of work. And the semi truck comes up with a loading gate. We unload. They basically leave four pallets on the street. I sign it, and they're like, "Well, see ya, kid." and I wonder if I have pictures of that. I don't even know if I had a digital camera in those days. And now I've got the arduous task of like breaking down 8,800 pounds of books on eight pallets. Four tons of books, box by box, into his crawl space. And so I run them into this crawl space, and that takes me all day, you know, into the evening to load up all the books in the crawl space. And I take a few cases of books back to my house, to my apartment, which is nearby. So the way Amazon works in those days is Amazon would sell any book. It has to have an ISBN number, which I was set up as BrianMedden.com Publishing Group. Sounds very like big and impressive. You know, there's some requirements. It has to be a perfect bound book. It has to be in English. It has to not be, you know, smut. It has to be have a barcode and ISBN number and all that kind of stuff. So you send Amazon one book, and then they, you know, get you set up in their system. They photograph the cover and everything and kind of put it online there. And then you send books to Amazon, and then Amazon sells them like just regular books out of their inventory. So based on your history and your title and everything, they will order as many books as they think they're going to sell. In my case, I don't recall them ordering any books immediately. They probably just said, "Yeah, we'll just keep the one you sent us to take the picture of." So the thing about Amazon though is, even in those days, they were very big on the like just-in-time warehousing and delivery and all that kind of stuff. So if Amazon is going to sell 300 books in a month, they're not going to order 300 books all at once. They're going to order 10 books at once. 30 consecutive days in a row. So, you know, they get a book, they sell it, they order, they buy another one, they sell that one, they buy another one, they sell that one. Maybe now they buy two because they're selling pretty well. Then they buy three. So I'm working at Compaq, and I get home from work every day, 5 o'clock. The local FedEx office closes at like 7. So I've got, you know, an hour after going from work to print out the label, box up the book, take it down to FedEx, and drop it to Amazon, which I did every day for like 6 months straight. Now, during this whole process, I had 3,000 copies of this book. The book actually did very well. And So, you know, they were ordering one, then two, then three, then 10, then 20, then 30. Then they're ordering 50 copies, 100 copies, 200 copies. And the local FedEx office in downtown Silver Spring is about the size of an office cubicle. And they got to the point where I had to bring in like 4 or 5 cases of books, 10 cases of books. You know, I'm coming in every single night with these things. And they're like, no. Nope, this is too many books, because they go out FedEx Ground, which doesn't go out till the next day, and they're sitting there all day, and they're filling up their office, and there's no storage space. So they actually banned me from dropping off my packages. They said, you have to go to our like regional FedEx facility, which is like up near BWI Airport. So now I'm doing the same thing, but I'm loading 200 books in the car every day after work. So I get home from work, print out all the shipping labels at my apartment, drive to my uncle's house, pull a bunch of cases of books out of my uncle's crawl space, load them in my car. They're so heavy, the car's like back end is like on the ground and the nose is up in the air. So I'm like putting them in the passenger seats and the footwell and kind of trying to distribute the weight as much as I can. And just driving these books, driving out to FedEx. And that was just day after day after day after day after day. Meanwhile, I start getting checks from Amazon. And the first check was like $2,000, which, you know, for the first month's worth of sales, which I had never seen that much money in my life before. And then in a check, right? And then, you know, the next month is $4,000, then $6,000, I'm getting checks $10,000, $20,000. And I had sold I sold through those initial 3,000 books in maybe 6 months or so. And I was working on a follow-up, a second edition of the book that was going to update for the new feature release. And it was going to just add some more chapters that I didn't have time to add in the book the first time. But I'm getting close to having that book be done. But then I run out of my inventory of the first 3,000 books. And then I wasn't really sure, like, I didn't really know what, like, do I want to print more and how many and all that kind of stuff. But at the time, Amazon had just bought a company called Lightning Source, which is print on demand. And so I thought, you know, I can actually do print on demand for the first book to kind of get me through a few months until I get the second book finished. So that way I don't have to deal with inventory. And print on demand is expensive. The quality was awful. I've got a few of them here. Print on demand now is actually fine quality wise. But back in those days, it was still like toner-based ink, and it was they were just awful, awful quality. But you know, it got me through those few months. And so I set up print on demand. And the reason I mention this is when you do print on demand with Amazon. So I sold a fair amount. I sold like maybe another 2,000 or 3,000 print on demand books in those intervening 2-3 months. Because these are now fulfilled by Amazon. So I'm not, you know, print on demand, I didn't make as much per book, but I also wasn't like schlepping books around. So that was nice. But it goes in Amazon sales reports. And it goes in the sales reports that like the industry sees in terms of book ratings and all this kind of stuff. And my book, selling 1,000, 2,000 copies of an IT book, even in those days, was just a huge number. It was one of the best-selling IT books of that period. And actually, my book, I've got screenshots of this, I think I got as high as 31, my sales ranking, like across all of Amazon. Like for about a week there, I was in the top 100 of all books Amazon was selling. And that was kind of happening like under the radar of the industry when I was doing the Amazon Advantage, when I was shipping them the books myself. But as soon as they started fulfilling from Lightning Source, it got put into all the sales reports and got on like bestseller lists and all this kind of stuff. And that's when the distributors start calling me. So the way the distribution works in the book industry is the same way software distributors work, where it's an exclusive arrangement. They represent your book to the trade. They take, you know, their 20% or whatever, but they get you, you know, wider, you know, visibility and all that kind of stuff. And I had actually tried to get a distributor earlier on. I put together all these packages, and they were like actually printed out in paper, like proposal, and here's me, here's sample chapters, here's who I am, here's what I think it'll sell, you know, marketing, all this kind of stuff. And I sent these kits to like 20 distributors, and every single one of them rejected me, because who the hell am I, and what is Citrus, whatever, X something. And so I was rejected by all of them. But now that the sales came in, and now that I was in all those channel reports, they were able to, you know, in the spreadsheets of sales, which shows the book, the title, the author, the amount, the dollars, and it shows who's distributing it. And that, for me, was always blank. So now the distributors start calling me, and now all of a sudden they're really interested in working with me because I'm selling some of these books. And so while I wanted to tell them to pound salt, you didn't want me before, why do you want me now? I also recognized that I did not relish the idea of doing more books, and that I had to fulfill myself, because I was also, you know, in addition to sending all these books to Amazon, I would get random orders from stores. My book was not in any stores, but you could, since it had an ISBN number, you know, you could walk into your local Barnes & Noble and say, hey, I would like the Brian Bed and Citrix book. And they look it up on the computer, and they've got, it's got my address in there and my email. And then they would send an order. I would literally get an order from, you know, Barnes & Noble store number 2415 in Duluth, Minnesota. Please send one book. And then I would have to get set up as a vendor and like invoice them. And it was just a huge, huge mess. So the idea of working with a distributor was really a good thing. Like I liked that idea. At this point, you know, I'm still doing the print-on-demand book. I got the second book coming out soon. And so I tell the distributor, which I ended up working with the independent publishers group, IPG, in Chicago as my distributor. I say, hey, I got this new book coming out. Let's put the new book in the catalog. And you know, you guys can represent that one. So they did. And so I signed the deal with them. And then when I got the second book, I'm still a publisher. Printing costs and new on the layout and page design, cover design, kind of stuff. When I do the second book, and by the way, the second book has an orange on the cover, which at the time I didn't know that Citrix used to be called Citrus. A lot of people said, oh, that's a great inside joke. Is it because of that? I had no idea. But I did that actually because there's a guy I worked with at Compaq named Stan Lampkin. And Stan Lampkin had gone into his local bookstore trying to find my book. And they're like, well, it's about Citrix. And he's like, I don't see it here, but let me take you to the nutrition section. I think they've got lots of other books on nutrition and citrus and that sort of thing. So I just thought that was funny. I never really put together the Citrix kind of thing really before that. So I put the orange on the cover for that book and got the distributor. And what was nice is, so I printed 3,000 copies of that book, but instead of having 4 1-ton pallets going to my uncle's house, they go right from the printing company in Mattoon, Illinois, to the warehouse of the distributor in Chicago. And I just had them, you know, the printer send me a couple cases just for promo stuff and then everything else. And then the distributor handled all the invoicing and billing and had the accounts with Amazon and all those things. But what was also cool about having a distributor is that's what got the book in all the stores. So at the time, this is now 2002, I think. At the time, once I got the distributor, you know, I mean, I was in Australia. You could walk into bookstores in Australia and find the book sitting on the shelf. You could walk into any Borders, CompUSA, Barnes & Noble, you know, anywhere, and the book was sitting on the shelf. And, you know, I did 3,000 copies of that of that next book, or of the second book in the first print run. I did, like, a second print run of, like, 5,000 copies. I did a third print run of another 4,000 copies. And at this point, I'm getting checks for, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a month from all these book sales. I'm out of debt. I used the money to, you know, put a down payment on the house that I bought in Washington, D.C. And I'm still working at Compaq as my day job. But the book money is just rolling in. So between the first – those two Citrix books combined sold like 20 or 25,000 copies. And it was just – you know, they were good books, but it was also – Citrix was new. Citrix was just catching on, like, you know how like the sort of VMware virtualization trend of, you know, 5 years ago when that sort of started to light on fire. That was what Citrix was doing in the early 2000s. And also remember in those days, there was no blogs. Like blogging was not a thing. There was, you know, online listserv, the thin list was still a thing, but like there was not, like the way people got access to technical information was by buying books. There was no ebooks even in those days. And so it was just kind of the perfect scenario of kind of everything coming together. And so that was, it worked out well. Now, around this time, there's also, there's always ongoing the talk of, you know, is there, Is Microsoft going to kill Citrix? You know, Terminal Server comes out. Windows 2000 comes out. Terminal Server is kind of built in. Windows 2003 comes out. There's RDP 6. Terminal Server is better and better. You know, there's talk of people using Terminal Server by itself instead of using Citrix. So I decided for the next book to write a book about Terminal Server. And that book I co-wrote with Ron Oglesby. And I also published that myself. Ron and I split the money 50-50 from that one. And we also, you know, same, I used the distributor IPG. It was on all the bookstores and on the shelves. And I think we did 10 or 15,000 copies of that book. Just sort of the Windows Terminal Server 2003 Advanced Technical Design Guide, I think that book was called. Had the spaceman on the cover, which is cool. I licensed that issue from that image from Boeing. So the books are going well, and you know me, I'm still working on Compaq. It's HP at this time, so Compaq, you know, was merged with HP. I remember the very first day I went to my first job interview at Compaq. It was the day that HP announced their intention to take over Compaq, and everyone knows the history of that. But I had a cell phone by this point, and I remember sitting in the lobby, like waiting for my interview to happen, waiting for the guy to come down. This is the lobby of the Compaq office in Greenbelt, Maryland, Washington, D.C. area. And Gabe calls. And he's like, dude, you're going to work for HP. I'm like, no, my interview today is Compaq. He's like, no. HP's buying Compaq. And I don't know if you remember the shock of that announcement. Because like in those days, it was HP, Compaq, IBM dominated the server space, and like maybe Dell was kind of starting to come up to be a thing, but the idea of HP buying Compaq was just ludicrous, and I was 100% convinced that Gabe was pulling my leg. He's like, no, you're going for HP, and I thought he was like playing a joke and going to make me look stupid in front of like my potential new boss and all this kind of stuff. So I was like, well, how do I like validate this? Cause there's no smartphones in those days. So I'm like, what do I do? So the security guard, front desk security guard, I just kind of nonchalantly saunter up to him. Like, hey, so did you see this HP thing? He's like, I know, that's crazy, right? Can you believe that? Like, so then I knew. So then the elevator doors open. My boss, Jeff Goldstein, the guy who will be my boss, walks out and he's like, so I don't know what's going on or if we can even still hire you, but I guess we should talk anyway. And I'm like, great. But anyway, you know, that was late 2001. I got, you know, got hired at Compaq, got the books out there, got the Terminal Server book out. And then meanwhile, I'm starting to get – so the books are doing well. I have the BrianMadden.com domain. I bought the – or I reserved the BrianMadden.com domain. I don't even remember if you had to buy them in those days. Years and years and years earlier, after reading an article in Fast Company magazine that Tom Peters wrote about brand you and the whole like personal brand and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to – BrianMadden.com, that's me. I'm going to make a brand. Crazy, crazy idea, right? And I had the domain. It didn't really have anything on it. When I released the books, I just kind of had some information about the books on it, like sample chapters and links to buy it and that kind of stuff. And but I also had like contact information. And because I was the guy who wrote the book, I was getting a lot of calls from people who wanted me to come in for consulting. And some of these projects, I would, if they were big enough projects, I would actually bring them into Compaq and like do them through Compaq. Other projects, if it was a small little things here and there, he was like, I worked from home at the time, so there's like, just do it and don't really tell anyone. I was doing a fair amount of consulting, and I was charging like $200 an hour or something like that at that point, which again was just like, I couldn't believe that people paid that amount of money at that time. And I'm like 22, 23 years old. But you know, I wrote two books about the stuff. I got 5-6 years of experience with Citrix, and I knew what I was doing. Like I felt confident and you know, was able to like help out in these projects and stuff. So at some point I decided like I wanted to leave Compaq, or leave HP, and I don't remember why. Like, I don't remember being unhappy there or anything, but just, I don't know, just a big company. Like, I've always been kind of entrepreneurial, and I'm a big company, like, I'm not a big company guy and that kind of stuff. So I decided I'm going to leave HP. And I had a lot of stuff on my schedule. Like, I was going to be speaking at iForum in Sydney, Australia, and I was doing other events and projects to wind down. So I ended up giving them like a 3 or 4 month notice. And so I ended up leaving there in the summer of 2003. And I think I was working on the Terminal Server book at this time. I think the idea was I was going to finish the Terminal Server book, like, just so I could focus just on that for a few months straight, get it knocked out, and then go find a job at some like smaller consulting company somewhere. And when I did, so I had the domain name brianmadden.com. But there's nothing on it. It's just a marketing website for the book. So, I decided I'm going to leave HP, finish the book. My grandmother, she had bought me when I dropped out of college, when I became like a business person. I'm saying that business person in quotes. She bought me a subscription to Ink Magazine, not to be confused with INK Tattoo Magazine. This is INC dot. The Ink Magazine was their tagline was like the small business entrepreneurs magazine or whatever. And at this point, you know, I'm doing like working for big companies, doing like enterprise level consulting, and she buys me this magazine, which, as far as I could tell, was geared for like, you know, stay at home moms who are selling Beanie Babies on eBay or whatever. And I'm kind of like, thanks, Grandma, you know, like that whole thing. And so I've been getting Ink Magazine for years. And it sits on like the toilet tank, and because, you know, no like smartphones again in those days, so you read magazines in the bathroom. And so I remember May 2003, and I've actually since looked up this article and found it. There was an article in Ink Magazine that was basically talking about weblogs, blogs, and how the article was something like, blogging is not just for teenage girls anymore. And the article was talking about how people were using blogs for actual like business type information, and consultants were blogging about their areas of expertise, and companies were thinking about blogging, and like there was like business stuff, and like actual like respectable adults were reading blogs, and that just blew my mind. And so I'm like, yeah, I need a blog. I'm gonna make a blog. And this is years, and this is, I think, 3 years before Google even bought Blogger. I mean, it's you know, this is for early. So RSS was not a thing. This is way early. So remember, I knew from the Tom Peters book, and that I had BrianMadden.com. I knew that my blog had to be on BrianMadden.com. And there were like commercial blogging sites, like on like Blogger had, you know, like Blogspot, but your URL would be like BrianMadden.blogspot.com. And I knew I needed it to be on BrianMadden.com. BrianMadden.com was running on a Windows server, like from a Windows web hoster company. And it was Windows because that's all I knew. And there were a few blogging platforms out there that existed for like Linux and stuff, but I didn't know Linux. So I was looking for like a Windows blogging platform, and it didn't exist. So I decided I was going to write my own blogging engine for Windows. And as a sort of backstory, one of the projects I did a few years earlier for the Cleveland Clinic was a citrus cost analysis project. And so I built this very huge, very complex spreadsheet, many, many pages, crazily complex formulas where you enter in all your applications and your server infrastructure and costs and all this kind of stuff. And it builds up like sort of cost analysis of using an external ASP, which is like a DAS provider now we call it, versus building your own internal ASP, which is, you know, private cloud, as we would call it, versus staying traditional desktops. And this spreadsheet, I worked on this project for, you know, 6 or 9 months. It was, they loved it. The analysis was there. This, incidentally, is how I was able to write the article, How to Lie with Cost Models, because I knew that I saw that these assumptions that you had to make for, you know, in these cost models could just wildly affect the results, like a little, like a butterfly effect, like little assumptions here and there on the front end just have drastically different results on the back end. So while I did try to make an honest effort to making a good solid cost model, I also realized that cost analysis is all kind of bullshit. Nevertheless, I actually presented this at Citrix iForum in, I think it was 2000. I talked about my cost model, what I was doing, and you know, ASPs were thing, application service providers. That's what they called, what we would call cloud providers today, where you could host Citrix desktops and Citrix applications. And so I had this idea where I was going to make a company that ran this cost model like as a service, as a white label thing that ASPs could use, so they could use it to make their they could do their cost analysis for their customers and show customers it's a good deal and all that kind of stuff. So I got the domain aspcostmodel.com. I got a copy of Dreamweaver Ultra Dev, which is web layout, but also does like VBScript for ASP pages and hooks into databases and all that kind of stuff. So kind of taught myself that. Built this whole website, presented the whole thing at Citrix iForum. Talked to a bunch of folks in the Citrix's iBusiness unit. I remember the two guys I talked to, and I remember their names, and I remember the conversation, but I will not mention that here because we talked about Citrix licensing this from me and this cost analyzer, and it'd be a great tool for all the customers, and I was like, I'm going to be a millionaire and all this kind of stuff. But that conversation kind of went dark, and then like 6 months later, Citrix comes out with the Ace Cost Analyzer, which is freaking identical to my thing in concept. And in my mind, they saw my presentation. They saw, so I sent them everything, the original spreadsheets, the code, all that stuff. I don't think they used any of my code, but I think like as a concept, they said, oh, we can build this ourselves and not have to pay this kid and all this sort of thing. And even when I called them out on it, they're like, no, ours is very different. For example, ours supports multiple currencies. So that was my first experience with like, sometimes big companies suck. Sometimes Citrix sucks. So anyway, though, because I had learned when I built the aspcostmodel.com website, I learned about ASP programming and like VB and databases and all that sort of thing. I wrote my own blog engine for brianmedden.com. And it was very simple. It just was like had like one table to hold articles and just looped through them and showed them. And, you know, and I added more functionality to that over time. Like I added on, you know, eventually, rating articles and adding on comments and all that sort of stuff. But that was the platform I wrote myself. And a bulk of that code, I remember I wrote on my flight from Sydney back to Washington, D.C. Sydney was the last iForum in 2003. It was like May 2003 that I spoke at. That's the last event where I like wore an HP shirt and spoke there as, you know, a representative of HP talking about Citrix or whatever. Wrote this thing on the plane, stop over in San Francisco. I wrote my very first blog post, I think like at the San Francisco airport. And it was, about like Tarantella by New Moon, I think. So I had, you know, the BrianMedden.com website, because I was leaving HP. The website had information about the book. I was working on a terminal server book. It had information about consulting, and it had, you know, this blog. And like a little bio kind of about me and that kind of stuff. So that was the beginning of BrianMedden.com in its current form of the blog was 2003. And if you go in the blog archives right now today, you can still go back to 2003, that summer, and see those original posts. And I think, of course, at the time I was getting like 10 visitors per day, 20 visitors per day, that kind of stuff. I remember I was on vacation a few months later in Maine when I got 100 visitors in one day. And I just remember thinking like, holy shit, 100 people today visited my website. I just couldn't, it just boggled my mind. So while I'm doing that, you know, the blog sort of, I don't know, catching on or whatever. When I was on vacation in Maine, the cabin we were staying at had some old magazines, like probably in their bathroom. They had a People magazine from like 5 years, it was like 5 years old, that was like a Where Are They Now kind of thing. And it's all these people who won the lottery or came into big amounts of money. And basically, you know, 10% of them are successful, 40% of them are exactly the same, and 50% of them are bankrupt. So I remember thinking at that time, you know, if I won the lottery or had like unlimited money, I would do exactly what I'm doing now. I don't have a job. I'm like working for myself. I'm blogging about Citrix. I'm doing consulting. I'm writing the book. It's just a really, really fun sort of thing. So I kind of realized that moment, like, I truly did not leave HP with the idea of not getting a job again. But I kind of realized after a few months of that, no, this is actually really going well. And I was writing some white papers for some people, and just, it was just a lot of fun. And the books were paying my way. I mean, I was doing consulting here and there, but the books were still wildly successful, and I was getting big checks, and getting, like, you know, money saved up in the bank and that kind of stuff. And that was, it was a good time. So that was summer of 2003. And I remember, I went to iForum that year. I remember the thin list dinners. I remember, and one of the things from iForum, and I think this was so iForum was in October in those days. This was the October, 2003 iForum. I remember talking about, this is when I got the idea to make my own conference. So Citrix iForum in those days was, it was owned and controlled by Citrix, but there were no third-party speakers. So, like, the only reason I spoke at iForum, for example, like in Synergy, is because I was an employee of HP and I was an HP-sponsored slot. There were no third-party speakers at iForum. All the sort of content that was supposedly good technical content was actually was like kind of more marketing type content, like Citrix was saying, like, oh, there's no limit to the number of, hosts in a data store. I can't remember what these apparent XP terms were. Browser, what was that thing? The master browser limit host, anyway. It was all marketing propaganda. It was not technical, and it was all marketing propaganda. But yet, here I was making all this money selling books. Citrix was wildly popular, and I was kind of thinking, if there's an event that was like iForum, but that was like vendor neutral and actually technical, I mean, that would just be a killer event. I would love to go to that. And I remember bringing up this idea. At the Thin List dinner at Shulo Steakhouse at the Dolphin and Swan. So this is October 2003, about making my own conference. And it's interesting. I've actually gone back in the past years and looked back to the Thin List archives. You can see my initial emails from those days also about this idea and all this kind of stuff. So we talked about it. I don't remember who was there in the room, the typical Thin List crowd. I'm pretty sure Ron Oglesby was there. We're talking about this event, and I'm like, I'm going to make my own iForum. And that's the name Bryforum definitely came out of that Shula's Steakhouse, probably after lots of drinking. I was like, what should we call it? It's going to be called, Terminal Server Expo, TS Expo, or Server-Based Computing World, SBC World. These are the names I'm kicking around in my head, or that I'm kicking around a lot as a group. And someone, I give Ron Oglesby credit for this, because no one else has come forth otherwise. Someone's like, nah, call it Brian's iForum. You got to call it Bryforum. And of course the whole room erupts in laughter, like, Bryforum. It's ridiculous. And that's that. So we get back and start, I started a Yahoo group, cause that's how you collaborate with people. So the people who are there start talking about this event and what it could be like and everything. I'm like, okay, we got to dial in the name. And like, dude, you have to call it Bryforum. Like, you have to call it Bryforum. And I'm like, there's no way. Like, Bryforum is ridiculous. And they're like, you have to call it Bryforum. So it was called Bryforum. This is end of 2003. Bryforum actually happened in April 2005. So there's 18 months kind of planning in here. And during this time, I'm living in Washington, D.C., so I was looking at different venues in the D.C. area, talked to the, we ended up doing it at the AFI Silver movie theater, and they didn't do any catering, so, we needed to bring in our own catering and buying food. I remember going to Costco and renting a truck and having, five of those, rolling platforms full of soda and chips and coffee and all this kind of stuff. Planning that conference, it's me doing everything. At this point, I had sort of a part-time employee, this girl named Nicole, and she worked like 10 or 20 hours a week doing like billing and invoicing and just kind of like running the business. So it was me full-time, there's Nicole. Gabe's living in Omaha, but he's got a regular job. Like, he and I are still best friends, but he's not like working at, you know, at my company. Just planning everything, knowing nothing, planning everything. Like, we got to print badges. We got to have like a badge scanner kind of thing, and like writing the software for the badge scanner and writing the software for like doing the videos and, you know, hiring a video crew and hiring a crew to bring in Wi-Fi, because that was a separate thing in those days, and hiring, you know, getting a like thin client devices to you know, have there. And it was just, you know, I was very, very naive with what I was doing. But it was, I had early support. You know, I tell a story before that it was John Byrne from Tricerat, where, you know, shortly after I had the idea of Brian Form, I told him about it, and he went and got his checkbook and was like, yeah, we want to be there in the high sponsorship you have. Let me know like what you need. And I'm like, I don't really want to take your check right now, because I don't know how much for, and I don't know what you're buying exactly or what we're going to have or whatever. But anyway, so that was, you know, and I picked all the speakers myself in those days, because I didn't know about the concept of call for papers. I'd never heard of. Benny Trish actually introduced that to me for the platform we did the next year. And so I sort of handpicked all the speakers. We, you know, got slides, all that sort of thing. The staff for Briforum was my sister and her boyfriend. My mother was there working the front desk. I mean, it was all our friends and friends of friends who were, you know, like room monitors and doing registration and all that sort of thing. Gabe took vacation from his job and, you know, came in and you know, helped out. We did have Emily that time. So about a month before Briforum, I was talking to my my buddy Chris, and he's a friend of mine from D.C., lived in the neighborhood, and his wife was Emily. And I knew Chris really was a friend, and Emily was my friend's wife, essentially. And I remember sitting at dinner, went out over beers, and like just saying, like, man, I think we may need to actually like hire a real event planner, because I'm in way over my head, and this event's a month away, and like, I don't know. It's really tough. And Emily's like, I think I might know an event planner who are for you. I'm really, who? And she just points at herself. She goes, me. And I'm like, you're an event planner? Because so like typical that like the guy doesn't know what his best friend's, his good friend's wife does for a job. She worked somewhere, I guess. I don't know. So Emily actually joined us like literally a month before that first Bri Forum. And probably worked, you know, 500 hours straight without sleeping. I know I had a lot of sleepless nights, and like the night before Briforum didn't sleep, not due to nerves, but just due to like workload and stuff I had to get done. There's lots of fun stories about Briforum, and I've told those in other, I've told those over the years, so I won't go into them now. But I will say this, is that the biggest challenge for Briforum, in hindsight, was the money. And, you know, so I had to get set up as a vendor that could take credit cards. And there was no like Square or PayPal or whatever in those days for credit cards. So you had to actually get a merchant account, which I got through Costco, and, you know, was able to like process, like hook into our web-based registration system and to take credit card processing. But what I didn't know at the time is there was even as a merchant account, there's limits on how much money you can charge. So what I'm saying, like what I mean is, you know, Briforum to attend was like $500. And so, you know, we had a couple hundred, like 180 attendees. So it's whatever that works out to, you know, a couple $100,000 in you know, like charges that are going through Visa cards that then we need to get deposited into our account. Well, the problem is after you run a whole bunch of cards, like the card processing companies, they don't want some merchant, especially some new merchant, to run up like $20,000, $30,000 in charges, get that money transferred into their checking account, and then just like disappear. Especially in our case, because it was for this event and it was taking place like 6 months in the future. And they're like, well, how do we know this is not a scam? So we actually ran into problems twofold. Number one, where I couldn't take money out of the account. They would give us like, I had like $80,000 in credit card charges I had swiped. I mean, the cards were swiped. I took the money. And I needed to pay, you know, I needed to pay the rental truck and the table rental place, and the video crew needed money, and the Wi-Fi people needed money, and the venue needed money, and I had to buy all these tickets because that's how we were doing it. Like, we were buying all the airfare for all the attendees and all the hotels for the attendees, and the hotel that were with the room block, they need money and all this sort of stuff. And there's no money because I got $60,000 in bills that are due yesterday. And I got $80,000 sitting in my merchant account, and I cannot get the money out of the merchant account. And I've talked to some hours on the phone, and just that's not happening. I ended up cashing my IRA at the time to use like as sort of, you know, liquid cash for us to use to get us through the pre-bribe forum build-up days. And then the other problem too is, even though the money was building up in the account, at some point the merchant processors just stopped accepting cards. So you would go to the Bridefront website and swipe the card or enter your card number to register, and the card would be declined. And I was getting these emails, hey, my card's declined. I talked to the bank. They said it's not them, it's you. And I said, yeah, we can't, you've got too much money built up. You're a new vendor. We can't take more money from you yet. And I'm like, well, give me some of this. You don't have to have a buildup. I'll take it from you. And so we actually got had to get that limit raised and changed. And a whole bunch of people, I said, just pay us later. Like, a lot of people went to Bridefront for free. And I charged their credit card like a month or two after the fact, just because I was like, I can't. Like, I don't have a way to take your money. Can you send me a check? You know, there's just a lot of sort of ways and like a lot of hassle to sort of make that happen. But overall, you know, Bridefront was successful. Did the next one the next year in 2006 in Washington D.C. Then did the next one after that in Germany in Darmstadt. That was sort of co-hosted with Vision App that Benny put together, and that was successful. Then we moved to Chicago in 2007. I never lived in Chicago. We just put the event there just because now we had a Bridefront in Europe. We figured most Europeans would go to Europe instead. So we made the U.S. Bridefront in Chicago just because it was more centralized. And it was like an easier city to fly in and out of. And there was no other big events in Chicago and that kind of stuff. So that's 2007. Emily's on board as an employee. 2007 was also when Gabe joined. So I think it was like January 2007. I had always wanted to work with Gabe in our own company. We always talked about making our own company and kind of fantasized about that. And, you know, I quit my job in 2003. And he was still working at like other consulting firms and other random IT jobs in the Omaha area where he had. So we were in Ohio together. I moved to DC. He moved to Omaha pretty close to the same time. And at this point, I think 2007, he's got a kid on the way. I think he was around that time. And basically, like, by 2007, you know, we'd done a few Bride forums. Things were looking good, and I felt confident enough that, you know, like, I could offer him a job. Like, he could come to work there without the risk of, like, the company actually folding. Now, we didn't have any money to hire him. It's me, Emily, and Nicole at this point. So I went – I cashed out more – IRA or 401k or something like that. No, I sold my house also. Yeah, that this time, 2007 is when I sold my house. Anyway, I went without salary for a while so Gabe could, you know, come on board and we could make the company successful, and, you know, off we went. So, yeah, it was everything's like rocking and rolling in those days. And, you know, we're doing the Bride forums. We're successful. We're still doing consulting. We're doing the training classes. Which a few years ago, before that, I had developed my own training class based on my book, where it's basically a 5-day version of the book in person, and it's me and a whiteboard and, you know, some servers, and it's sort of a Citrix masterclass, we called it. And so it's for people who are currently Citrix admins who just want to kind of sharpen their skills and take things to the next level and that sort of thing. So we're doing lots of training classes and, you know, making decent money on that. That's actually the next one of their stories where a funny run-in with Citrix, because, you know, for training facilities, I just used random training facilities like in all around, you know. So there's a company called TCP, Training Coordination Professionals, where you know, I just do a contract with them, and they know that in a training facility, I need 16 seats set up in classroom style. I want snacks and coffee in the morning. I want meals, you know, lunch and all brought in, and I need this equipment like whiteboard. And they have everything set up, and they also have all the contracts with all the local, like, centers, local training centers and stuff. And so I can just say, hey, I want to do a class in Chicago. And then they do all the logistics of the venue, and I just sort of show up, and then I just pay them for the space rental. Well, Citrix at the time had decided that they didn't like my training class because it was like unauthorized or whatever. And Citrix actually put out an edict to their calcs, the Citrix Authorized Learning Centers. If you were a Citrix, if your facility gave Citrix classes, you were not allowed to offer any unauthorized Citrix classes. And so the CEO of this training company, the logistics company, calls me and says, so I got a weird call, and I've been in this business 30-whatever years and never had this before, where the training facility said you are not allowed to do a class in their facility, and we have to pick a new facility. And that's because Citrix went down on them and said, if you let this class happen in your facility, we're revoking your calc status. And it was interesting because they it wasn't them giving the class. It was like they had a spare room, and I was subleasing it from them for the week. But, you know, that didn't matter. So that was an interesting sort of challenge with Citrix. The other interesting challenge with Citrix was they did the same thing with Google, where I had AdWords. Like, so if you type, you know, Google, if you type Citrix training into, you know, Google search term, then my ads would come up on the side that says, you know, training class from Brian Madden, whatever. And Citrix went to Google and said that I was infringing on their copyrights, and that my whole Google account was taken down. So I had to deal with that for a while, and having no advertising. Actually, I think that case ended up going to like the Supreme Court or something, not because of me, but like Penthouse and Playboy had the same kind of thing, and the courts ruled that no, you know, companies are allowed to make ads that keyword on their competitors, you know, like trademark terms or whatever. So that one kind of worked itself out like a year later, but I had no advertising for a while. It was rough. The other thing that's funny is Citrix had accused me of ripping off their in the book. They said I didn't write the book. I just plagiarized their advanced concepts guide, which the guy who said that, and I remember him also, it was ridiculous. I forget the guy. Who's the guy? Mike. I can't remember his last name right now. But the guy who wrote the advanced concepts guide, I got to know later on, and he was fine. He didn't think this. He knew what these two things were. But it's funny because Citrix actually had accused me because it said, hey, this advanced concepts guide came out like, you know, in April, and your book came out in October, and clearly you just like took it all and just like plagiarized all of our concepts and IP into your book. What's funny though is they only knew about my second book, because the first book, since it was only sold on Amazon, had so much limited distribution. Then I was like, wait, your advanced concept guide came out in April? Yeah, my book actually came out in January. You know, the first edition, which is largely the same book as the second edition. So if you think these documents are suspiciously similar, I think you owe me some money. Funny how they dropped that at that point. But yeah, so between that and the, you know, the ACE cost analyzer and shutting down the training classes, shutting down advertising, they made my life difficult in those days. But that was, you know, whatever. That was just them being a big company. And it was a new era, you know, like there was a new, in this day, it's like the idea of a person who was, you know, sort of independent and making a name for himself and like not controlled by the company. Like that was just not, you know, that was starting to happen everywhere in the industry, of course, but that was not something that Citrix had sort of dealt with before. But, you know, obviously we made amends later on, and yeah, everything's fine now. So we're 2007, Gabe's an employee, we're doing Briarform in Chicago. And we had moved, so Briarform was in April at this time. And then we started planning the next Briarform we did Briarform in Amsterdam 2007. We did Briarform in Chicago again 2008. And then around the 2008 timeframe, so the way Briarform worked is I was living in DC. Actually, by 2008, I had sold my house, and kind of that's when I went homeless for a little while and traveled around full time. And I think I was in New York City at the time. And then for Bride Forum, I got an apartment for a few months in Chicago before Bride Forum. So that way I was the guy on the ground to just do everything Bride Forum needed logistically there, like collecting, again, like printers, badge scanners, thin client terminals, video cameras, video equipment, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I never really like lived in Chicago officially, but I would, you know, rent a furnished apartment in Chicago for a month or two before each Bride Forum took place. So it was during that time in 2008, so it was like April, May 2008, that I get a call. I think I got an email from John Brown at Tech Target, and he's like, "Hey, give me a call sometime. We want to, you know, talk to you." And Tech Target at the time, their websites were just the worst laid out websites, most just horrendous. If you think they're bad now, man, look at them in 2008. And I got so much spammy email from them. Like, I didn't, TechTart was not a go-to website for me. And I just, I don't know, kind of ignored. I think I had tried to do some work with them before, like as an independent expert on some webcasts, and they didn't pay very well. And I didn't really do anything more with that. So, you know, I just had no, you know, someone from TechTart emailed me to say, "Hey, call me." That did not ring high as my to-do list, especially when I'm in Chicago trying to very last minute put together all the details for Bride Forum. So then John emails me, I don't know, 2-3 times. And I think, I don't remember if he ended up calling me or emailing, but basically he said at some point, "We want to talk to you about acquiring your company. You should call me back." So I call him, and he talks about how, we're going to get in this, you know, they had a website for virtualization, and now desktop virtualization is picking up steam, and they're going to maybe split and make it a website on, you know, desktop virtualization and server virtualization. And if they do that, they're going to be competing against me because they want to do conferences and events and papers and websites. And I already have the audience, I already have the conference, I already have the rotations, like, let us just buy you. And you become like our desktop virtualization division, essentially. And I think what I told them basically was like, "Well, it's like 3 weeks to Bride Forum. I'm working, you know, 20 hours a day. I don't have 2 spare seconds to think about this at all. Let me call you back in like a few months after Bride Forum." So kind of kicked that down the road. I did give John and a couple of other editors from Bride Forum like free passes. Editors and tech art free passes to Bride Forum so they could attend Bride Forum. So they attended Bride Forum and just kind of saw the event and saw that it was legit. And like we had, in those days, we're getting 350, 400 people coming to Bride Forum, like 30 vendors. It was the 2008 was in the glass ballroom at the end of the Navy Pier. It was just gorgeous, gorgeous venue. You know, great conference. And so they attended that. Around this time also, I had, so, you know, our company, Nicole, left. She got married and had kids and decided she didn't want to work anymore. But her cousin, Laura, became our new business manager. So it was me and Laura. Emily was still there. Gabe was there. And then Jack actually had worked for us. He had graduated college and he was working for us as well, just doing like a lot of everything else we needed sort of work done. So it was 5 of us in the company. We put on Bride Forum. And when I got the call from Tech Target saying that they might want to, you know, partner, acquire, whatever. The first person I called was Kevin Goodman, because he is sort of like the closest thing I had to like a mentor, I think, in my career. And I was like, so this company just called us and said they maybe want to buy us. Like, what do I do? And he walked me through how that process works and how the, you know, the paperwork and here's what happens. They're going to ask for this. Here's why they want to know this, you know, all this kind of stuff. So after Bride Forum was over, you know, we started the conversations in earnest with Tech Target. It was not a goal for us to sell the company. We were not a growth oriented company. We were 5 of us, all good friends, all working together, just really enjoying our lives. In fact, the way that we did budgets at Tech Target, or pardon me, the way we did budgets at Brian Madden Company in those days was kind of backwards. Like, all of us decided how much money we wanted to make that year. Like, what do we want our salaries? Let's give us all 5% raises. Sound good? Okay, yeah. And then we would work backwards from that and, you know, to create the budget. And so then we'd say, okay, here's what all of our salaries are going to be, and we need this much money to run the company. Then Laura would tell us, okay, well, you need to do, you know, 7 training classes and write 2 books and, you know, 300 hours of consulting and 2 Bri forums. And I'm like, I don't want to do, you know, that many training classes. So, well, if you write another book, then we can do that. So it really was worked backwards. Like, we didn't make any money. We didn't care if there's any money in the bank at the end of the year. We just cared that we were able to pay ourselves our salaries and not bounce any checks. And so that that's kind of how we ran the business. So TechTarget, you know, when they sent their like due diligence forms for us to fill out, I mean, it was just piles and piles and piles and piles of paperwork and this and customers and money and revenue and accounts and, you know, a lot of information we just didn't have. I remember getting on the phone, I think Amy Cleary was who still runs our operations at TechTarget today, talking about Bri Forum and what the budget is for Bri Forum and the biggest vendor. We just did not know any of that stuff. Because, like, we're like, well, what do you mean, like, budget? Like, how much we spent last year? And it's like, well, what, like, the goals? I'm like, it's just, I don't know. It costs what it costs. Like, we just, like, do Bri Forum and we pay for it. Like, money comes in, money goes out. And, like, I honestly don't even know if we knew if Bri Forum was profitable in those days. Like, it didn't. It all kind of went to the same bucket. which I'm sure they were thrilled to find out that, like, we just had no clue whatsoever. But, you know, our website, we were doing 600,000 page views a month in those days, and like 20,000 views a day. I mean, it was successful. We just were not running it in any way like a business. But, you know, we were unsure about TechTarget, but they flew us to their office in Boston in 2008. And Gabe and I went. I don't even know if they knew who Gabe was. I think it was like, oh, yeah, there's 2 of us. And they're like, what do you mean 2 of you? So we go there. We stay at the hotel. We go to this meeting at the old TechTarget office. And it's got like the TechTarget CEO, the president, the COO, this guy John Brown, who's still there also, who's our boss, who's the guy that actually found us and did the acquisition and everything. And the first words they say, our CEO of TechTarget often doesn't wear socks with his loafers, or I think he claims he wears socks that are too small, you can't see them. But in my mind, he wasn't wearing any socks. He's wearing like corporate casual loafers, no socks. He leans back, puts his sockless shoes up on the table, and says, "We want to take the bitch work off your plate, so you two guys can focus on what you do best." And I think at that point, Gabe almost had to hold me down because I had been running this business for 5 years or whatever at this point, and had, you know, dealt with cash flow crunch. And because I remember even a few months before that, I had to go without salary for a while because we had, you know, $200,000 in accounts receivable and bills due, and, you know, checking the mail every day. Do we get a check? Do we get a check? Do we get a check? And so it was tough to run a business. And so we're pretty much like, yep, that sounds good to us. So, you know, it took a few months to work out all the details. The deal closed in November of 2008. And I am now a TechTarget employee. And my TechTarget has an office in San Francisco. And I have been living in San Francisco for I was new to San Francisco. I did not move there because of TechTarget, but I had just moved to San Francisco. And I asked John Brown if I could get like a desk and stuff at the new office. And he's like, why? Why do you want to go to the office? I remember showing up there, like, in my mind thinking, you know, this is a big moment and everyone's going to know who I am and I'm going to be famous with inside TechTarget. And it's funny because my very first thing, so when the deal actually closed, they did a press release, which they didn't tell me about. So I was at some other event. And the website, like Twitter is a thing at this point, blows up with whatsonbrianmadden.com. It's going to TechTarget. They're going to ruin it. And it's very, very negative response from the world. the president of TechTarget calls me and is like, dude, what's going on? Like, is this deal okay? Like, do we make a mistake? I'm like, no, you could have told me, you know, that you were going to do a press release. Like, I would have. Because I was assuming I would do a blog post about it and explain what it was and what we're doing and all that sort of thing. So my, like, the deal closes, the money shows up in my account, and like 45 minutes later, I'm like, oh my God, I made the biggest mistake of my life. But that was just a little blip. And that was, I mean, that was 7 years ago. It's November now. So November 22nd, 2008, 7 years ago is when TechTurrent acquired us. Emily and Laura went on their own ways. Jack went back to school to get his master's degree. Gabe and I joined TechTarget as employees. And it's been great. I mean, since then, you know, I've written this a lot. You know, TechTarget is a big, it's a 700-person publicly traded company. So we have the pressures of, you know, like quarterly numbers and getting revenue in, you know, into the quarter and sort of managing expectations. And there's expense reports and travel policies and, you know, all that kind of stuff that typical big company has. But, you know, one of the things that we asked about when we were in those meetings was asking about editorial independence. And they told a story of how they, you know, lost some big advertising deals based on what their editors wrote, and they stood behind the editors. And TechTarget does have a very strong editorial independence. In fact, it's sometimes annoyingly strong, even from my standpoint, because I think a lot of the editors think that what I do is super shady, since I also do sponsored projects for vendors in addition to doing the independent coverage of the industry. But overall, for us, it's been great. And there's long been a – TechTarget has never once tried to censor what we wrote. One time I did an article about VMware that they were really upset about. My boss at the time called me and said, hey, I'm about to go on this meeting with VMware. The article you wrote, like, it's legit, right? Like, you stand behind it. You weren't drunk posting or anything. I'm like, nah, the article is legit, man. He goes, okay, thanks. That's it. That's all I needed. And another vendor a couple years ago, I wrote something about them that they didn't like, and they pulled a $500,000 advertising campaign and from us, and even kicked us out of their party at VMworld, because some friends of mine I had there said, oh, you should go to the, you should come to our party and like show there's no hard feelings, and they asked me to leave. They said it was inappropriate that I was there, and they and my boss and my boss's boss, so my boss, the publisher, and the president of the company went in a meeting and were yelled at this vendor by an hour about, you know, how this is ridiculous, and it's, you know, it's, you know, the article is garbage, and they shouldn't allow this kind of stuff. And if they don't pull the article and issue a retraction, then they're going to never do business with them again. And the president of TechTarget said to that vendor, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. Please let us know if you change your mind. And I mean, you know, they got our back. Incidentally, by the way, the article turned out to be 100% correct, and that vendor now still does lots of business with us, and all's fine. But overall, yeah, 7 years at TechTarget has been great for us. And, you know, we're able to keep on blogging, keep on with independence. Like, I did an article literally called Fuck the San. That was the title of the article while I was at TechTarget, and that was fine. So we're still able to kind of keep on doing our thing. You know, Bryforum in some ways is not quite the same magic as it was when we were independent. But on the other hand, it's still a good, solid event in terms of content, still, you know, good, solid event in terms of technical independence, in terms of the vendors who are there. And I like the fact that I don't have to actually print name badges myself and go through catering menus and all that kind of stuff. So I'm able to do the fun stuff with Bryforum, which includes, you know, the picking the content and the speakers and the schedule and, you know, the MC and the geek out and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, so that brings us up to TechTarget. So there's lots of other stories in there, but I've amazingly talked for 2 hours. So that is the story of, you know, birth through TechTarget. I'm 37 years old, and TechTarget has been very great for me. My career has been really good. But, you know, selling a small blog and conference, a website, while it was, you know, nice, like padding to my bank account, this is not these sales that lead to retirement. So I'm, you know, as a 37-year-old, I'm assuming I have approximately 30 years of career in front of me. And I don't foresee, you know, leaving this industry anytime soon. Because, you know, even though I'm not 20 years in IT, the space is still really interesting. And it's, you know, look now and this whole future of desktop, future of applications, there's all the mobile stuff, there's the web apps, it's just still really interesting. And I have no idea how it's going to end, but I like being, you know, having a front row seat to watching it all happen. And, you know, I love working with different vendors and introducing people to each other and hearing stories of how things came to be and product directions and all this kind of stuff. And I still work with my best friend. So it's, you know, it's a pretty amazing thing that Gabe and I, you know, are actually able to work together every day. I work with my brother, which is awesome. If I could get my other brother to join the IT world and join us, I would do that too. And so we get, you know, we've got a good team around us. We've got Mariah and Justin, who are our project manager and our sort of video audio engineer. We get to do all these like stupidly fun videos. And I don't know, it's just being in the space right now is pretty interesting and not a bad job. So I can't imagine anyone actually, you know, having the slogging through listening to all this for those few hours. But now if I get hit by a bus on the way out of here, at least my story is out there. And you are now caught up. So after 2 hours and 5 minutes from San Francisco, this is Brian Madden, and I thank you so much for listening.